down in the Vancouver airport, I found a book about Knut Rasmussen. Very good book about his explorations. And he was this great explorer, but he also collected stories of the old people. He particularly would seek out the old women and get the stories. And this he heard while traveling. He heard it while traveling west of Baffin Island and east of Alaska. And it's called The Tale of the Little Mosquito. There was once a tiny mosquito that flew out into the world. It was so small that it thought people did not notice it. But when it was hungry, it landed on the hand of a boy, and while it rested, it heard someone say, "Uh-oh, that nasty mosquito, crush it fast." But then the mosquito could suddenly speak so that the boy could hear it. "Spare my life, spare my life. I have a little grandson who will cry if I do not come home." And then the storyteller says, "Just think, so small and yet a grandfather." And I just love this story. I love this story so much because it's so easy for us to forget that a mosquito doesn't have relatives, right? You know, and it's like this metta practice is meant to help soften our heart enough so that we get out of our human-centered reality. And I feel like coming back to Hollyhock the same time of year, I feel like, for example, there's a song sparrow that sings in the bush near where I stay for 30 years. And I know that's not the same song sparrow, but I know it's probably a great-grandchild. And I feel that connection a lot. Like, I feel it very deeply. I just bow, and I'm so happy, particularly the way the planet's going, that there still are song sparrows, or that there still are ducks. There's much less, but there's still some. And you know, this is why the planet is the way it is, because we don't get it. We don't get that they're family. They're our family, but that they have families. We're just so cut off. It's very sad. My father's mother came from Newfoundland, Morton's Harbor. And I still sometimes will look at the map. I've never been there to see in that time, you know, late 1800s. It was like, it's like, I can't even relate to how remote it is. And I've lived in very remote places. And she always would say to me that I didn't know what snow was. You know, that I could never imagine how much snow she grew up with. When, you know, I didn't visit her that often, but when I did, when I was very young, she would get up at like 3 a.m. and cook. And I would hear her in the kitchen. I would get up too. I loved that my mom didn't cook at all. So I loved her capacity to function. And so I would hear her call everything the same word. So she would call the stove Johnny. And she would call the pots and pans Johnny. and she'd call the spoon Johnny. And so she was constantly talking to Johnny. And when I was a kid, I was like, wow, is she crazy? You know, like I was like, whoa. And I was old enough to know, wow, this is really strange. But then I just got used to it. And my last year when I was on a month-long self-retreat, and I was feeling cut off. And I was walking along the road, and I started calling everything Johnny. And it cut it. It just cut the disconnect. It was amazing. I'm not saying you should call everything Johnny. Maybe Matilda, or, you know, whatever you want. But it's like, it's more that sense that she had that relationship. In my retreat this past time, part of it was a long retreat, so maybe early middle of it. It was a darker time for me, and I started just having the sun. The sun was like this great friend. It was sort of like, for some reason, it was the only thing that reached me at that time, going for walks in the morning. And I think that you'll find when you're here on the retreat that there will be a tree or a stone or an eagle or something that will touch your heart. And we, in the traditional sense of the metta practice, we call that the benefactor. It's an old-fashioned word, but when we say, you know, cultivate the easiest being or place you can find, that translates into the category that we were taught of benefactor. You know, and it's tricky teaching in a modern culture because that word even sometimes people can't connect with. So the idea behind it is that when I say, you know, you connect, it means that you connect, but something happens in the heart. Like it can just even be very quiet, but it can just be like that's teeniest, tiniest softening. It can be very quiet. I think sometimes we expect such intensity, but it's not necessarily like that. I think in a modern sense, for most people, there has to be a certain numbness or disconnect in the busyness, or a sense at least of a self-importance in the busyness. So understanding relationship and how our attention is related to relationship is the basis of both practices, of the metta practice, the loving kindness practice, and the vipassana. When you kind of plummet the depths of what that meaning is, it means that we're learning to access a relationship of love and wisdom with anything that appears, that we don't have to banish any part of ourselves or any part of anyone else or any part of the universe because you have practiced a relationship. So for example, if fear comes up, there isn't that sense, oh, I thought I got rid of that last retreat. It's more like, oh, it might not be, oh boy, my great cousin fear, but it is your great cousin fear, but you know, maybe you want it to be a distant cousin instead of like next door. But whatever, these practices are about freedom of choice. And so it has nothing to do with getting rid of anything or getting anything. It's much more how we're relating to the experience. How are we relating to the experience? It doesn't matter what the experience is, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. In Burma and in Thailand, which are Buddhist countries, there's a lot of imagery of the Buddha's footprint. And it feels very meaningful to me, that sense of, it's so grounded, right? To have embroideries and beautiful art of the Buddha's foot. It's not the Buddha's head. It's not the Buddha's heart. It's the Buddha's foot. And that's something to really contemplate. It's like, it's so grounded. It's so embodied. And it's so meaningful in that it's really that chance, anytime we take a step, that there can be peace. That anytime we take a step, that there can be peace. Thich Nhat Hanh, his incredible description of refugees in a boat, and that when anybody panics, everybody can go overboard. But if one person is peaceful, it can save everybody. And this is really motivating. You know, this is important for us. This is not just theoretical. This is happening. Happening. It's happening. If you're really agitated about something, it's helpful to back off. It's not that there's anything wrong with the agitation. It's much more that you can transform it into something healthy and helpful rather than unhelpful. This is a quotation from Srinivasagadatta Maharaj from the book I Am That. The waters of life are thundering over the rocks of objects, desirable or hateful. Remove the rocks by insight and detachment, and the same waters will flow deep and silent and swift, in greater volume and greater power. The same waters, the same turbulent waters, this is what we're doing, flow deep and silent and swift. So we're not changing anything, right? We're learning how to relate differently. One of my first teachers was named Thongpulu Sayadaw, and right before I met him at the Boston airport, it said that he had spent 33 years in a cave meditating. And he had come out of the cave to come to America. And I was just like, wow, you know, this was 1978, and I couldn't even imagine it, right? Like, I was like, 33 years in a cave. It didn't even compute. Like, wow, okay, great. And I used to bring him his food at this meditation center. He's very quiet. He made us take the bed out of the room because he hadn't lied down for 33 years either. That was startling. Okay, take the bed out. But anyway, whenever I would come in and offer him food, he would say to me, keep your mind like water, not like a rock, but like water. Every time, just keep your mind like water, not like a rock. And that was really helpful. And I think sometimes for me, that kind of simplicity and elemental way of describing how the mind or heart can be is helpful. The Buddha described metta as like a soft light rain. Kind of perfect for the Northwest, huh? But you can, you know, it's so, again, that it's not like a downpour, but just that soft rain. It's softening. And what is it softening? The rock. The resistance. Why do we teach it? Why are we so motivated to teach it? Because we know how much modern people need softening. And when you practice long enough, you start to see that it's the resistance to what's happening that's so painful. It's like it's the resistance to the grief that's so painful. The grief isn't so hard, but it's not wanting it, thinking you shouldn't have it, that you got rid of it, that you want happiness without grief or whatever. It's like, ah, it's all that non-acceptance. So the metta, our deepest motivation for teaching metta or offering it is because we know that being with things as they are is hard without the softening. So what, another way to say that is that resistance is totally okay. Because we can hear about, okay, water, rock, and then again we'll start feeling like, oh, resistance isn't okay. But resistance has been our great protector. And I think that the best imagery I can use for that is if, and the garden is such a great, the garden in spring, this is the perfect time to hear the metaphor over and over spring. Because you look at the flower buds, and we're each like a flower bud, we all open in our own time. But we're closed for a reason. And that if you know it's okay to close, you'll be more likely to try opening. But if you think you just have to be open all the time and feel all the pain in the world, when you don't have the protection of mindfulness and or metta, then you won't open. It's like this, I think of it as like the iris of the eye that can open and close and open and close and open and close. So another way to talk about loving kindness or metta is that it's love, it's an unconditional love, but what that means is that it's love infused with wisdom. And whenever we hit the conditional love, it usually means that we're not accepting something painful. And if you look at, and this is where the wisdom comes in, because the wisdom tells us that life is pain and pleasure and neutral. I love coming up here again because you see, maybe you like eagles, but you don't like ants, right? Like there's that sense of looking outside of ourselves. You know, you look at who you might already judge as somebody here that you don't like, and it's not based on anything, nothing. And you look at people that you might like, and then you talk to them at the end, and you're like, wow. I don't like this person, right? Like we're just nuts. We have all these ideas about people. And it's not based on anything, but inside there's this idea that somebody's more pleasurable, somebody's more painful, and somebody's more neutral. Same with animals. And it's like that's our job, is to start noticing that we can have these preferences, but that the judgment hurts if you believe it. So another way that we talk about the process of a loving kindness retreat is that it's called breaking down the barriers. And sometimes ourselves will be the difficult person. And so it's a gradual process in a lifetime of breaking down the barriers between ourself and ourself. Or it's like breaking down the barriers between yourself and someone else, or breaking down the barriers between yourself and a mosquito. Do you see? It's like this process of starting to see where the barrier is. And in, what I love about this practice is that the means and ends are the same. So you're not breaking the barrier down with willpower. And you're not breaking the barrier down with a battering ram. You're breaking the barrier down through love. So that if you hit a place in the process where you have a contraction around yourself, you're supposed to go to something easier. It's beautiful. Or if you're doing somebody else or something else and you hit a barrier, or you have a memory of somebody and you hit a barrier, you're meant to just wisely pace it and back into somebody or something that's easier. So just as in the Vipassana practice, you're meant to cultivate an anchor to come back to when you're lost, like the breath or hearing. In metta, you cultivate an anchor of somebody or something that's easy. They're an anchor. You cultivate it, this being over a lifetime. You can have several. It's very beautiful. I learned maybe everything about gentleness from understanding this. And this isn't something that Sayadaw Upandita explained. It's like you figure it out yourself as you do it. So we'll start feeling like we're failing, that it's all our fault, that we can't, you know, just feel unconditional love for ourselves or somebody else. And it's not even part of the process. It's just assumed you're going to hit the barrier. Of course. Because what is the barrier? It's just aversion to unpleasantness. It's aversion to pain. That's all it is. We usually like ourselves when things are going our way, right? You know, it's like when things are going our way and it's like, I'm a great person, you know, things are great. And then things aren't going our way and we're bad and it's all our fault. And this is what you're starting to cut through and with others. So you see a homeless person on the street, which is like every pretty much block in Vancouver, and what do? It's painful. Do you shut down? Can we send metta? Unconditional love. I just happened to be at a long retreat with Sayadaw Upandita when the first Persian Gulf War broke out, and my nephew was sent. He was a Marine, so he was in the first group that went. And I learned so much about what metta really was, because I was very close to him, and I would try to do metta for him, Bush, and Hussein. I can tell you, I hit barriers like you wouldn't even believe. And I was on retreat, and it was so hard. And it all came down to, okay, Tony, my nephew, I love you if you don't die. And all the like, why did you join the Marines in the first place? And, you know, just like amazing. stuff, but it's like, wow, you know, just that feeling of the barrier. And then Bush, it's like, oh, easy, I'll love you if you stop the war. No problem, right? But that's not it. That's conditional. That's not unconditional. Hussein, President Saddam Hussein, same thing. I love you if you stop the war. Great, easy, right? But that's not it. It was all these ifs. I love myself if I, like, follow the diet the cardiologist told me to follow. And then, you know, that dessert was there last night, that chocolate pear thing. That's not on his list for me. But I had some, you know. It's like, and it was really good. But you know what I mean? It's like, that's a simple example, but it's endless. So what you start to see when you start trying to do yourself, you start trying to do someone, and as we go along with the practice, we will remind you this is not about someone's behavior, our behavior, others' behavior. It's about the feeling essence of a being. It's about tuning into the goodness that's in every being. It's finding it. It's finding your own goodness. It's finding others' goodness. If that's not a word you relate to, you find the peace in them. You find the love in them, the compassion. You find yourself, you know, in the, again, in the traditional sense. And we, of course, we'll bring this more and more in, but you're meant to, when you bring somebody up or yourself, you're supposed to think of their qualities that touch your heart. And so even if you're doing a lake or a sky or a child or whatever, but you stop before you start wishing them well or abiding wordlessly or whatever, but you're meant to just tune into what touches your heart. When I first started this practice, I had a very difficult stepmother, and I would sit there like, okay, we got to think of something positive, right? And I'd be there for a long time, you know. And then when you practice it, you finally get better at it. And she actually tried to feed me. She cooked well, and I really started to tune into that and appreciate that. It started changing me. It started changing my relationship with her. You can always find something to start softening the heart. So that metaphor of a flower bud, when we start to open, and you know, when you look at these flowers, there's sun, there's warmth, there's water, it's like there are certain conditions for opening. And here we have the silence, we have the loving kindness practice, mindfulness, you have certain conditions, and we start to open. But we can't control what we open to. And we don't like that. So when we open to joy and sorrow. We open to pleasure, pain, neutral. It's like you're opening. And this is why it's so important to know that as you're going along, if you hit resistance, respect it. Your system is just going, I just need to stop for a while. It's like braking a car. It's okay, you respect it. If your system knows that you're going to respect resistance, it's going to start to trust you. If you just fall back on the willpower and just the battering ram, and that's most of our conditioning, it's not going to open. Why should it? It's not going to trust you. And in the metta practice, Stephen will talk more about this tomorrow night, but that there, it's like it's meant to purify. So we're meant to hit the unconditional love, but it's meant to help us face self-hatred and anger at others. And it's meant to help us look at the difference between, say, romantic love and unconditional love, or nostalgia and unconditional love. So these will come up. You're not trying to get rid of it. You're trying to actually get a relationship with what isn't metta as well as what is. And I think that we can't say it enough. It's like this practice, vipassana, metta, it's actually meant to do that. It's not just about the good stuff. It's about the whole picture. And often, you know, when things are kind of going along and there's some concentration, there's some mindfulness of metta, there's some energy, there's some joy, whatever, you know, you're kind of going along, and we can get very identified, even more so, I think, in loving kindness practice with, oh, this is going so well, I love this practice, I wish it was 2-month retreat, you know, it's like we just go along and then, man, the self-hatred hits, and it's like, oh, man, it just can hit so hard. And it's like, oh, God, I wish I just came for, like, you know, a weekend, it just happened. You know, we just identify with it being hard. And that you go through that over and over again enough to start realizing that both are important. Both are part of the process, including the sleepiness, the restlessness, the doubt. You know, it's like the whole show. So I don't know if you were sitting here today and going, I was hoping a lot of sleepiness would come up today because I need to get a better relationship with it. You probably didn't say that, but that's the idea. So going along with the felt sense versus behavior, as you see with our instruction, we're offering a few different ways to do the loving kindness practice, but one of them is with ourselves and benefactor. And just try to remember that sense that when you do yourself, get in touch with the felt sense of yourself or the image as well, or when you were a child. This is very, very helpful, whether you're 10 years old or 95. It's not about the behavior in this particular practice. It's about that feeling essence. So for some of us, you know, in the next few days, the practice will be benefactor oneself. Benefactor oneself, phrases, or one phrase. For other people, Steve and I and Pari are teaching it so that we're using our body, we're having our body be an anchor, and it's including a non-conceptual metta. So it meaning that we're being with the physical sensations, with our body, with the vipassana practice. So when Steve guided it this afternoon, when I guided the practice this morning, we're bringing the attention through our body, we're feeling the sensations mindfully just as they are, that's vipassana, and then we're having a relationship of loving kindness with just what is there. So that's integrating, it's like an embodied, non-conceptual metta. Very important. And then within these two, there is that starting to see sometimes when we're receiving, what's easier? You start seeing what's easier, sending or receiving. And sometimes it changes. So try not to think that, you know, it's always one or the other. Often it's when you start discovering that they can be there and they come to some kind of completion that you'll get a sense of abiding with. And don't worry about this. Like, it's like if you hear abiding with, like, what is she talking about? Just let it go. It's a lot of instruction. Or if you hear sending or receiving, and one of them is how it's working for you, don't try to do the other. It's like we're offering a lot because there's a lot of people in here that have practiced many, many years. And there's a need for a different way of integrating it into the Vipassana practice. The most important part of what I'm saying is that sometimes the metta is very, very quiet. So please don't get an idea that it means that metta appears one way. It can appear many, many different ways. It can be very intense, it can be very joyful, it can be almost imperceptible. I'm trying to think if there's anything I'm forgetting. Oh yeah. We haven't really shifted to this yet, but we will shift to being with our Vipassana practice, sixth sense door awareness, and just bringing kindness to whatever appears. So that is another way. And you know, when you have your interviews, you can ask, or in the hall, question and answers. But we are trying to offer different ways, as we've said, because we have found that these have all appeared in our own practice as we've gone along, and we've found them all useful. So just trust where you are at with it, trust what's working for you. If you're confused, just note confusion. It's just confusion, no problem. And you can just shift to maybe some, if you've done enough Vipassana, you would just shift to some Vipassana or some metta for yourself. There's a great poet that died last year, Galway Connell. So he was a lot of our contemporary on this planet. And he said that the secret title of every good poem might be tenderness. I would say... Pardon? Yeah, the secret title of every good poem might be tenderness. The secret of every awake moment might be tenderness. And that's kind of how you know there's some unconditional love sometimes, because there's that sense of tenderness, but without control. Tenderness without control is unconditional. It's like an unconditional softening. I've mentioned this before, but I have had a relationship with three feral cats in where I live. And there's a mother with her two daughters. And they teach me a lot about human beings in the way that they hardly ever have peace and harmony all the time. You know, it's like there's always some jealousy going on, or they want some food that the other cat has. It's pretty amazing. And on my retreat, there was a moment where all three were in one area of this little porch, and that hardly ever happens. It's better if they don't even eat in the same place. They have such, you know, rivalries, or they like to be alone, or it's very interesting. So they were all on the little porch, and they were like kissing each other, you know, and they were like playing around. And I went out there, and I really totally not realizing what I was doing, and I said, "Oh, it's such a happy family." And I'm like, "Why can't you all be like this all the time?" It was hilarious. And they're looking at me like, "Yeah, right." And then the next day they were fighting as usual. And it was so cool to see myself project, you know, this whole idea of that these feral cats should always be harmonious. You know, it's like we do it all the time with each other. Yeah, it's great when we have a mirror of another being that can reflect it a little bit more clearly to us. Of course, I have no control over them. That's the best part. See, I can't make them do anything, or, you know, they're feral. So that's the best part. That's why I know about tenderness without control. On a very technical level, when we talk about concentration, there is a kind of concentration. If we put concentration over here and wisdom practice over here, the concentration, it's called fixed concentration. And say we turned all the lights out in the hall right now and put a candle in front. And just the practice with fixed concentration would be, if you had knee pain, ignore it and look at the candle. If you notice thinking happening, you'd ignore it and you'd look at the candle. And if you had any fear happen, you'd ignore it and look at the candle. If the sound of the fireplace happened, you'd ignore it and look at the candle. You get the idea? If anything happens, you ignore it and you look at the candle. It's called fixed concentration. And the goal of that practice is seclusion, rest, a kind of one-pointedness, and it's a kind of bliss. So if you came for bliss, you came to the wrong retreat. But that's the idea, is that, and the reason it's about bliss is that you ignore everything. You're excluding everything, and you're ignoring everything, but there's a kind of rest in it because you're not opening to anything that's happening. And the metta practice can be taught somewhat like that, where you're just repeating phrases and you're staying with yourself or the benefactor. We are teaching that somewhat. If you're inclining toward that sense of like building some concentration, which is just kind of repeating the phrases, staying with yourself or another, walking or sitting, it kind of builds a kind of seclusion and rest. But the metta practice is in itself purifying. And you'll see that even if you tried to keep that going, you would hit barriers. And you can't go across the barrier without understanding, without the wisdom. So the opposite of that kind of practice is the Vipassana practice, which is a compromise initially, so coming back to the breath when you're lost in thought, or coming back to the breath if you can't be with a physical pain or coming back to the, it could be the sound, so be careful, I'm just saying the breath now, but you come back to one thing, one object over and over again, but it's still moving. You're not like the candle, you're not trying to notice moment to moment change in the fixed concentration, you're just staring at the object. Over time with Vipassana, you're compromising at first where you're coming to the breath, but then if something's predominant, you go to it. So you kind of start with a little bit of exclusion, but then you start including more and more, and as we know, it leads toward including everything. Anything that can happen in the universe, you're learning how to be mindful of. And if you can't be with something, you anchor. You build up the concentration, the rest, and the courage, the courageous energy to be with whatever's happening again. So there's that extreme spectrum. And the way we're teaching the metta is sometimes to do it with a little more concentration and sometimes to do it with more inclusion. I have a friend that had to do some chemotherapy and radiation last year. And when he went into the hospital, and he was in a room with other people, and there was a certain point where he started crying. And the doctor came over to see him, and he asked him if he was okay. And he said, I'm just so grateful. I'm just so grateful I learned the practice from Sayadaw Upandita. And I can lay here and I can be with the physical sensations that they're changing and I can wish myself well. And I can, then he really started crying and he said, I can care about all the people I'm in the room with. And it's just like, it's such a deep spiritual experience. I'm so grateful. When I came out of retreat quite recently, I had heard that this show was on public television. We have a Hawaii public television. And I heard that Ram Dass, who wrote the book Be Here Now, was going to be shown just a little bit of part of this program. So he's a very old friend of Steve's, an old friend of mine, and so most of us know that he had had a stroke some years ago. So he's in a wheelchair, lives in Maui. And the show was about nature and being in nature and the stillness of nature. And so they talked to Ram Dass and he said something I just was so touched by. He said that he'd never really known contentment until recently. And I felt, well, thank God he's being humble. It's like, thank God. How many people are being that humble? That's a real teacher. I was so impressed. I started crying because I was just like, good for you, Ram Dass. And he said, I've never known contentment, and it's like I'm just able to be with the sound of the wind and the trees and the mist and the rain. And he just like had found the stillness and this peace just recently. And I think a lot from having to weather that stroke. He's really still. He's stuck. You know, and it's something we're all so afraid of, and yet he's gone through it to this incredible contentment, and that's not the happiness you get from bliss. It's not the happiness you get from concentration. It's the happiness of peace, of stillness, and that's what we're really encouraging you to find. It's always here. Sometimes I think the biggest block in the human world is kindness to ourselves. And if we had more of it for ourselves, there'd be less war and more peace. So I'm going to read just the first part of what the Buddha taught about metta. And we'll talk more about the source of this, but I just wanted to end with this one little part of it. We'll read the whole thing at some point. It's called the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium or short or small, the seen and unseen, those living near and far away, those born and not to be born, may all beings be at ease. That's a lot of beings. Let's sit for a minute.